that he's going to get them ready in a professional manner and let them run their own mental show. He wants to get in their head, but not to change anything, just to help them see some things that he sees. He's learned from his own mistakes. I skipped the fear because I started so young, Freddie muttered to me one afternoon, his voice just barely audible, sometimes hoarse, but clear. I never had fear in a fight until after the first time I got knocked out. Because I had 150 amateur fights and 27 pro fights before I got knocked out, I was never even hurt by anybody. I was invincible. Then one day, I never saw the punch coming, and I woke up on the floor. Freddie laughs, smiles, and eyes me sideways through his thick glasses. I got up. The guy rushed me and put me down again, and fuck. And then the ref stopped the fight. He shook his head, deeply amused by his younger self's chagrin. From that point on, I knew I could be knocked out, and that changed my whole game, my attitude. Before that, I would go in reckless. I would take a couple to get mine off, too. But then, I knew what could happen, and it made a huge dent in my fighting career. I wasn't fearless anymore. It put a question mark in my head. Freddie maintains that was the beginning of the end, the start of the downhill slide of his fighting career. He also broke his hand and had a long layoff, which led to his living a less pure lifestyle, furthering the decline. Freddie contrasts this with the example of Manny Pacquiao. Manny is one of Freddie's most famous charges, a Filipino lightweight with a dynamic style. Manny is the most popular person in the Philippines by far, bigger than any celebrity or politician. He's considered a national treasure. In an interview, the Philippines Secretary of the Environment said, "Manny Pacquiao is our greatest national resource." Manny's amazing, an action fighter, explosive, strong, ripping fast. His body is a piece of Filipino iron, taut, whip-like. He came to Freddie years ago with a lot of ability, but raw. And Freddie polished him into a gleaming gem, the pound-for-pound king. The bewildering technical display he put on against Oscar De La Hoya showcased all his tools, a master in his prime. And Manny has been stopped earlier in his career. Freddie said, "Manny, he's been KO'd, and he just says there's always a winner and a loser. Tonight just wasn't my night." And that's a pretty good attitude to have. It didn't hurt Manny. It made him better. He learned from it. He knows it could happen. And most guys don't think it could ever happen. Freddie was talking about himself. I asked him more about it, trying to get at the root of it. Why did a loss for Manny become a positive thing, and a loss for Freddie become a negative one? Freddie said, "Well, first thing is my defense was my offense. When I'm punching you, you can't punch me. I was 100% attack. When I got knocked down and hurt, when I lost that fight, I just couldn't accept it. For me, losing is unacceptable. I won't even do sit-ups in the ring because you're never supposed to be on your back in there." I had a fighter who once wrote, "Oh shit," on the bottoms of his shoes, so that if he got knocked out, you'd see it on TV. But I could never do that. It was the beginning of the end for Freddie. He went about 50-50 for the rest of his professional career as a fighter. Stylistically, defense wasn't part of his game. Manny, he's more accessible. He can accept when things don't go his way, Freddie said. I think maybe it's about the Philippines, the lifestyle there. They're pretty passive in a way. I mean, the traffic is bad and the street is filled with horns, but nobody gets road rage. I was watching basketball and I'd see fouls that would lead to a fist fight in the United States, and they would laugh it off. Manny knows that every fight has a winner and a loser, and sometimes it's not his night. But for me, it was unacceptable. For me, there was only a winner. There's something very durable about that fatalistic acceptance of third world survivors. Manny's father abandoned the family when he was 12, and he grew up dirt poor in the Philippines. Even today, when they go to Vegas for a big fight, Freddie stays in his hotel room alone, and Manny has 10 people living with him in his suite. It creates strength, a buffer of home and country. You can watch him relaxed and at ease with the distractions of his extended family around him. Manny took that stoppage. He dealt with it, and he learned from it. It just wasn't his night. Now, he works his abs religiously, so he never gets knocked out by a body shot again. They found a weakness in him, so he works to take it away. Freddy discussed how Ray Boom Boom Bautista, another fighter of his, was dealing with the same issue, coming back after being knocked out. Freddy peers at me through the long tunnel of his thick glasses and drawls, "Is he going to come back as a better fighter, or is his career over?" "So how are you going to help him?" I asked. Freddy says, "You give him a lot of positive reinforcement. Tell him it could happen to anybody. You've knocked out a lot of guys. Fighters are hard-headed, and when they're stubborn and doing something wrong but keep winning, they can always fall back on that winning formula thing. But now, with one loss, I got some clout. When you lose, I got some ammo." Freddy will use the loss to work on some fundamental things that he had been trying to get Boom Boom to do. He'll work on the little things, but the little things add up. A tall, good-looking older man with long blonde hair, wearing a casual tropical suit, came in the door, and Freddy's eyes lit up. It was Donnie Lalonde, a former world champion who'd knocked down Sugar Ray Leonard in the fourth round, although he lost in the ninth. Donnie was into real estate in Costa Rica. That was the thing about Wildcard. It was chock-a-block with celebrities, and anybody could wander in. Donnie shook hands and leaped into the conversation. I told him I was looking into the mental aspect of fighting, and Donnie chuckled and said, "You've got to have already done the thinking in the gym. In the fight, you can't have your mind wrapped up. You can't be thinking instead of fighting. It's about reacting." Freddy told us a funny story about the purely mental side of things, about Steve Collins fighting Chris Eubank for the middleweight title in 1995. Collins had very publicly gone to a hypnotist to make him stick to Freddy's game plan. Whether or not that made a difference was sort of besides the point, because his opponent, Eubank, thought Collins was inhuman now, just a fighting machine. Freddy laughed. So the bullshit worked, and the hypnotist took 33 1/3 for the next 3 fights. He means that the hypnotist took that much of Collins's purse, which is a lot more than a trainer gets. This topic led us to the rumble in the jungle, when Muhammad Ali fought George Foreman in Zaire. Ali, one of the great psychological warfare practitioners in boxing, had local witch doctors hex Foreman, and Foreman, somewhere in his heart, believed it had worked. Which means it had. Just the shadow of doubt can spell doom. Freddie weighed in on an eternal boxing debate. Everyone always asks, Ali or Tyson? Well, Ali would have fucked with his head and made Mike a mess going into the fight. Pure power for power, Mike would have knocked him out. But Ali could have gotten to him mentally, and I think he would have, because Mike was so weak mentally. Josh Waitzkin, a chess prodigy and martial artist, and whom I'll write more about later, wrote a book called The Art of Learning. And in it, he describes the different types of chess kids he was teaching. He discusses at length entity versus incremental forms of learning, so classified by developmental psychologists. Entity kids think their chess skill is born of natural and innate ability, a pure talent, while incremental kids think they learned chess incrementally, step by step, and that hard work pays off. Josh would give his students impossible problems, well beyond their level, that no one in the class could solve. So all the kids would fail that problem. But then, when he gave them other, manageable problems afterward, the entity kids would struggle. They had broken mentally and were unsure of themselves. The incremental kids would just go back to work, slogging away. Entity kids were brittle. When they lost, their faith in their talent was shaken. The incremental kids, who believed in the power of labor, would keep digging in the trenches, even if faced with insurmountable problems. It reminded me of Gable talking about a wrestler on steroids. Make him do something that wasn't perfect, and he'd crumble. Maybe that was the steroid trap. It would make you physically stronger, but mentally weaker, prone to breaking. When Freddie Roach lost, his world was shaken, and he never fully recovered. He knew his skill had come from hard work, but he was convinced his invincibility was a pure thing, a part of the universe. And when that was revealed to be untrue, it had hurt his game. One of the old boxing truisms is, frustrate a puncher and he'll fall apart. A puncher is a fighter who hits hard, with a big punch. It's a natural gift that coaching can help, but you can't teach power. The puncher relies on his big punching. He hits guys and they go down. As he works his way up through the boxing ranks, this is the law of the land. He hits them and they disappear. Now, he gets to his first title fight, his first big fight, and he hits his opponent. Boom! And the guy is still there. The guy can handle the punch and keeps coming. So the puncher hits him again, but the other guy is still there. Now comes the crucible for the puncher. Does he go to pieces? Or does he buckle down and keep fighting? Can he find another way to win? Mike Tyson, one of the greatest punchers of all time, rarely fought past 6 rounds. If he hit you and you were still there, he'd mentally break. He'd bite your ear off to foul himself out of the fight, or not answer the bell. Successful fighters have things that work for them, and work incredibly well. But the great champions are those who can accept, internalize, and understand defeat. Waitzkin's Tai Chi teacher, the renowned William C.C. Chen, whom I studied with briefly, called this investing in loss, and it means study your defeat without ego. Let defeats happen in practice without reverting to your old habits, and then grow from it. It's an essential skill, for even during a fight, the fighter needs to be able to understand and accept when he is losing and change his game plan in order to win. The 10th Weapon of Muay Thai. I dutifully followed my annoying, oblivious GPS through the ice-black back streets of Cambridge, Massachusetts, into Somerville. Somehow, that little box knew what it was doing, and I ended up where I was supposed to be, on the broad street of Broadway. The gym nestled underneath a lawyer's office, on a street littered with dive bars, dry cleaners, and lawyers. I walked to the small, nearly hidden side door, and as I pulled it open, a wave of humidity roiled out into the cold winter air. I had been to Sitio Tong Academy before, to shoot an interview for the Boston Globe, but the place had been empty. Now, it was packed. Sitio Tong Boston, the other is in Pattaya, Thailand, is a tiny gym with astoundingly low ceilings. Just when you think they couldn't get lower, there's a beam that is even closer to your head. There are several places where, if I bounce too hard, I might ding the top of my skull. There was a dense crush of humanity. All men, almost all young, nearly all massholes, and the air was swampy with their breath. There were 3 different levels of Muay Thai going, and there were probably 100 guys training in a gym that was crowded when it had 30 guys in it. It felt like a slave ship hold or a submarine. If there was a fire, about 5 people would make it out, and the rest would burn or suffocate, bodies stacking up, jamming the door. Mark Delagrati came out and shook my hand, and he was warm and welcoming in that Boston way. He laughed and said with his heavy accent, "I feel like we know each other, although we never met." Which was true, because I had seen him fight and watched him coach on TV, and he'd read my book. Mark is a young, pleasant-looking guy with dark hair and an easy smile, an obvious Italian background. His eyes are bright and watchful, often underneath a Kangol cap, a little old-school Boston street. Mark's been extremely successful with adapting Muay Thai for MMA. He's become known as one of the best pure striking coaches in the game, and a great tactician. The fighters he coaches were on a vicious winning streak in the UFC, something like 9-0 when I showed up. He's doing something right. He set me up with one of his coaches, a guy who was smaller than me, and with great control, just to mess around. And we had a good time, just playing. I thought of how things had changed since MFS, when Pat had thrown me in with Tim Sylvia. Of course, every now and then, someone might land a clean leg kick, which would garner a harder kick in return. But we kept it pretty civil. Mark wanted me to have fun and be happy. But he also wanted me to be out of the way, not to get mashed by his top guys or spaz out and hurt someone with fights coming. He was everywhere at once, listening to complaints, hollering advice, keeping time. I was a little amazed about how extended he was, doing everything himself, but he seemed to thrive on it. Over the next couple of weeks, I hung around and talked to Mark when I could, and I got to know him a little. His gym is in the basement of his father's law office, and he grew up right in the area. He talks about his youth with a little reservation. I grew up with a bunch of rough kids. A lot of them are either dead or in jail, and I was on both sides of the fence. I had friends who were troubled, but we weren't broke, and we were raised well. Every time one of my friends got into trouble, I'd go hide in the gym. Mark credits traditional martial arts with keeping him straight, on the right path. Mark met Guru Guy Chase and studied the Inosanto curriculum. Dan Inosanto was Bruce Lee's greatest student, and his curriculum is a combination of many arts. Jeet Kune Do, Bruce Lee's hybrid fighting style, which combines a dozen traditional arts with Western boxing. Pencak Silat, an Indonesian hybrid martial art with a lot of weapon aspects. Shoot wrestling, ground fighting, a precursor to modern MMA. And Kali Eskrima, Filipino stick fighting. Mark's initial exposure to martial arts, with a broad background and the philosophical tradition of borrowing what works best from different places, would prepare him well for MMA. Mark originally opened a multicultural martial arts center in the same place where the Muay Thai gym is now. This was in 1992, a year before the UFC started, and Vale Tudo was still a relatively unknown Brazilian tradition. Mark still wanted to fight, and he discovered and fell in love with Muay Thai, spending time and fighting at the famous Sityotong camp in Pattaya, Thailand. For a long time, Sityotong and Fairtex were the only camps that took on foreigners. It turns out we may have overlapped in Thailand, although we never met. Mark had been bit by the Thailand bug. I went back to Boston, and 2 months later, I was homesick for Thailand. He trained hard and fought well and earned a place in the camp. Eventually, he was welcomed into the Sityotong family by crew, teacher, Yotong. In 1998, he turned his martial arts center into a Sityotong Muay Thai academy. Crew Toy, Crew Yotong's son, would come and visit for a month at a time. But Mark found another trainer who would have far more impact. He heard rumors of a Thai boxer who was working on some shady visa in a Vietnamese kitchen on Newbury Street. This was Ajarn Tong, with the fighting name Satsit Sibri, who had been a successful Thai boxer and whose family owned and ran a small camp in northern Thailand. Mark brought the Thai boxer into his home to live, and he laughs about it. I had Thailand right here. I lived it in this little basement apartment in Somerville. Ajahn moved in with me and Marie, Mark's long-suffering girlfriend and now wife. I learned the language, he held pads for me every day, and I lived Thai style. The sink would get clogged and I'd find chicken feet in it. So I'd yell at Ajarn, "You can't throw food down here, we're below the street," but he'd swear he didn't do it. Mark is laughing hard now. "What, I don't eat this? Marie don't eat this? How'd it get in here?" It almost sounds like a sitcom setup. Mark continued to go back and forth to Thailand regularly. He fought in the world-famous Ratchadamnern Stadium in April 2003, and won with a second-round TKO on a low kick. That was a high point for me, and Kru Yotong urged me to semi-retire. I wasn't going to go that much further, and I was more important as a teacher now, for preserving the art. I'm a conservator of Muay Thai traditions and techniques. A few years later, though, when Mark was back at Sityotong, training and relaxing, something odd happened. I'd been at the beach all day. I had a belly full of rice and a sunburn, and when I got back to camp, I noticed all this commotion, and I knew somebody was fighting that day. Turned out that somebody was Mark, fighting a Thai in an exhibition bout for Songkran, the winter festival. He hadn't been training to fight, but he was assured repeatedly that it was only an exhibition. So I called a friend of mine, Peter Hoovers, a Dutch guy who lives in Thailand. He knows everybody. And I asked him about it. He laughed and asked me, "Have you ever heard of a white guy fighting a Thai in an exhibition match? No such thing. You're gonna fight the kid." Mark had actually been slated to fight this same fighter some years earlier. He was an ex-military guy, had something like 400 fights. I had nothing to bank on but being totally relaxed. Mark jumped in the back of the truck with his trainer and went to the fight. Right before the first exchange, I knew it was on. You could feel the energy. It was a real fight, no holding back. But Mark smiles. It was probably my best fight ever. I kept chipping away at him, and in the third round, I finished him with a series of head kicks. I was in the worst shape of my life. I was overweight. But some guys are like that. I was a nervous fighter. My business was based on my reputation. For some guys, it's better if they don't even know. They're just training hard and sleeping well. And then you tell them, the fight's today. I didn't have time to think about it, to scenario the fight to death. When a fighter has too much time to think about it, he actually clutters his thoughts. Mark recounts seeing this with the older Thai trainers, something I'd seen as well. The retired champions, I'd see them drinking and smoking and not training. But they could take fights and stay so relaxed because they had so much experience. I saw one retired champ who was horribly out of shape take a big fight, and by the fifth round, he was putting on an old-school clinic, spinning elbows, climbing up on the guy. I could relate to that now. If you got no pressure, nothing to lose, and you're mentally content, you can fight and not get tired. Stay within your parameters. I learned a lot about the mental game from the Thais. I think the biggest thing about what they do is they're very proud of the art, of their camp. They have the utmost respect for Muay Thai. It's really the one thing they claim is theirs. The only reason Thailand has always been free is that Muay Thai has always been around to protect it. When you have something you hold dear, you consider sacred, it's harder to take it from you. For the kids who fight, it becomes about business much later on. But they always have that base pride to rely on. On the other side of the country, at the Fairtex Muay Thai gym in San Francisco, I spoke to an old-school Thai fighter named Jung Sanan, the Wooden Man. He'd earned that nickname because he took so much damage and never seemed hurt. When opponents kicked him, he seemed made of wood. Jung Sanan is a decent-sized Thai, but still short, with the big round head, battered doughy face, and heavy scars over his eyes. He was smiling, enjoying himself, his mind sharp and his grasp of English good, even though his accent is thick and he speaks in a soft Thai burble. His real name is Anucha Chayasen, Noom to his friends, but to me, he was Jung Sanan. He was a little bored with me, but still happy and pleasant with that natural Thai goodness and warmth that is so refreshing. He had been a 2-time Lumpini champion and an ISKA welterweight champion, among other things. He was a Fairtex lifer, brought to San Francisco to help anchor the gym in America. He spoke quickly and laughed all the time at himself. I'm really quiet. I'm not mean or an asshole. I listen to my trainer. That's it. My trainer tells me one thing, I do one thing. If he tells me two things, I do two things. He grinned and shook his head. That's it. In Thailand, that's the mental game. It's not complicated. I am slow. In the gym, they call me Big Head, Balloon Head. 20 years ago in the camp, they call me Balloon, at Bong Phli. Bong Phli Fairtex was the same camp I had spent 6 months at, back in 2000. My first trainer, Malit, was the big trainer for me. He brought me up and took care of me. When I was at the top, it was different. Jung Sanan becomes my style. Forward, don't show pain. It all comes down to my trainer. If you don't listen to them, you out. Because of gambling. They control you, to be Wooden Man. I don't want to be Wooden Man. I want to be a smart guy. Here, he makes the arm gestures of a Muay Thai fighter with a shifty, smooth style. But my trainer control me. And Philip, the owner of the camp, behind me too. He wants strong fighters, good fighters that are aggressive and strong. Every trainer has a different technique of looking at the body, to teach him how to be a forward fighter, or a technical fighter, or fast fighter, or heavy punch, or leg kick. It depends on body style. I'm tall and lean, and I have a big lung, bodhi, good stamina. They just see big lung. I can run with the top fighters when I'm young. I follow them in everything. He's talking about the camp system in Thailand, a whole different universe. The fighters there are essentially chattel, property. They have no options, owned by the camp. If they want to leave and fight elsewhere, the new trainer or camp has to buy their contract. So you do what your corner says, what the boss says. It's what happens in the third world when you're poor. You do what you have to do to eat. Sometimes, when they try to teach me smart things, I can't get it. I can only do one thing, keep coming forward. They try and teach me fake here, step back. He is laughing, short and quick, shaking his head. I can't do it. That's why my trainer teach me the style of knee, 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 come forward. I have to train very hard for that style, but I am healthy, lucky with that, fighting all the time. I come very fast, and I win first 8 fights at Lumpini Stadium. Then I lose one. Then I win for another 7 times or so, and always the same. First 3 rounds I get beat up, because I start slow. Techniques are not good, but I have good heart, and I can take it. And now, I am glad to beat them up, after they beat me first, after that punishment. So they call me Wooden Man. I hate the Balloon Head nickname, so I don't say it when the newspaper asks, he said gleefully. But Jungsunan turns thoughtful about what having a nickname and public identity can do for a fighter. For me, it was the same thing as Golden Boy. He was talking about Oscar De La Hoya and Golden Boy Promotions. It was his promotion name, and he has to represent it. It is a real thing for him. He has to be the Golden Boy. Rampage is the same, Quentin Jackson. The nickname and the personality in the ring have to mesh up. Even if you are a nice guy, in the ring, you have to mesh with your promotional personality. They call me that way. I have to be that way. That's how I feel. It goes back to what fighting is all about. Honesty and identity. You have to know who you are. There is no dissembling about your character in the ring. There is deception. Fighting involves faking one thing and doing another. As Randy Couture said, no lies get told when you're in there. You can't lie about being in shape, about knowing the techniques, about being faster than him, about being stronger or tougher. The truth will out. You have to listen to the corner. Think of nothing. Listen to my trainer and Philip. They control you to be that way. And the Thai fighter has to be like a robot. I fight you eye to eye. I see you. The corner man, the third eye, he see everything. He see me and you. The corner changed the game. The reason for such strict controls over fighters? Jungsunan smiles at the innocence of my question. The naivete. Gambling. 95% of fans are there for betting, to make money. The fan can make you fight different way. In the U.S., the fan come to support you, to see your skill, to see a show. Over there, it's for betting, and it makes me upset. If Muay Thai fighters in Thailand could get respect like here, it would be so good for the Thai boy. But in Thailand, they can't afford the ticket unless for gambling, to make the money back. If you love Muay Thai here, you can be a good fighter. Here they respect you, and nobody will beat you up if you lose. You won't lose your home, your living like in Thailand. Here they admire you even if you lose. 75% of American fighters survive by themselves. They fire you if you aren't a good corner. Totally different in Thailand. In Thailand, you have to do what corners say. You can't fight anywhere else. If somebody else wants to train you, he has to buy your contract out from me. When you watch a Muay Thai fight, you become aware of how important composure is. The Thais fight with epic steely composure, never showing pain or emotion. Unless it's to try and sway the judges. They act with their faces about how they feel the fight is going. It's almost like soccer players when teams try and draw a foul. Or the B-movie acting in the NBA. I asked Jungsunan about it. Use face. It comes to the judge. You kick me hard, but I show it's okay. My belai, the ubiquitous Thai word for never mind. The judge say, oh, he's okay. For the judge, for the system, for the crowd, for you, for the gambling guy. John Wayne Parr is an Australian Muay Thai legend, and he provided more insight into the Thai appreciation for composure. Wayne lived and fought in Thailand from 1996 to 2000. And has since continued his professional Muay Thai career. He's been fighting the best in the world for 9 years in Japanese mega events, such as the K-1 Dynamite Show. In 1999, he was a rising star, featured in the first kickboxing magazine I ever saw, On the Beach in Darwin, Australia. I remember the Thai publicity shots of him posing with six guns, like a cowboy. That same magazine had the advertisement for the Fairtax Muay Thai camp, which looked pretty good to me after sailing across the Pacific. He and I discovered each other on MySpace as I was finishing this book, and I asked him about the mental game he'd learned in Thailand. "The first lesson I learned is never show any emotion while fighting," he wrote me from Australia. "And if you want respect from the Thai fans, you never give up until the final bell." I've seen some Thai boys fight their heart out, for 4.5 rounds, getting a sound beating. Then, for the last half of the last round, they stopped fighting and waited till the clock ran out. When we got back to the camp, the boys would cop an earful from the trainers, till the point where they would start to cry. They would be ordered, even though they were busted up, to run and train the next day, because they didn't deserve a day off until they learned to fight till the end. He continued, "If you fight with all your heart, take punishment, get cut yet still manage to wipe the blood out of your eye and keep walking forward, the Thais will accept you as a warrior." It might sound strange, but to have the respect of the Thais is just as important as a win, because they have a very high standard. If they give you the thumbs up, you're halfway there to becoming a champion. Wayne told stories of seeing other Westerners come into Thailand to fight, but quail at the first sight of their own blood. Muay Thai utilizes the elbows to attack, and the tip of the elbow can cut like a knife. Many foreigners would fold up their tents when they got cut, but not Wayne. "I would rather go out with half my face missing, losing the fight, but still getting a pat on the back from the Thais. They would say, 'Jai Di,' or 'Good heart.' If you can prove yourself in Thailand, then once you come back home fighting other Westerners feels easy. You have already faced the scariest of scary. There's nothing that they can do that the Thais haven't done. I fought an English guy in 1998. He cut me 5 times in 5 rounds. I ended up with 54 stitches after the fight. Not once did I think about giving up. I kept walking forward, applying pressure. I lost that fight, but even now I have people coming up to me, saying how they love to play that fight in front of their friends who have never seen Muay Thai, to show them what being a warrior is all about." Back in Boston, Mark and I talked about Thailand. Years ago, I spent 6 months training in Thailand, and by the end, I felt the disconnect between Thai trainers and Westerners. It goes deeper than just language, although that's a big part of it. The foreigner coming in has a hard time understanding the system, who's in charge, what it all means. The Thai trainer can't easily communicate the more complex ideas of timing, breathing, or composure, and they might not anyway. They train together in the ring, but watch each other across a cultural chasm. I thought Mark would probably understand this as well as anyone. He speaks fluent Thai, and has spent a good portion of his adult life in Thailand. Mark muses aloud. "It was hard for me, figuring out what makes them tick. I watch Kru Yotong raise everybody, and he's watching to see who wants to be there. When two little kids argue, they get the gloves put on and go fight 5 rounds in the ring, with all the adults cheering like crazy. I realized what it's all about. It's ranking." Mark's face lights up with the remembered revelation. "When the fighters eat, they eat in order, like a wolf pack. The alpha eats first, the omega eats last. The whole camp is like that. The champs go first, and the little kid who lost, he gets fed last and gets picked on for a few days. The fed stay fed. It's survival. A lot of those little kids, their parents couldn't afford them." Mark develops this theme, and he's got a destination in sight. Kru Yotong takes them in. They don't have anything else to fall back on. When you have nothing, and then you have a father figure, a mentor, and food and training, you become connected to that person. I do the same thing here. After training, we hang out, we eat together, our families know each other. They've all been to my house, and I've been to theirs. Camp means camp, food, shelter, and fire. Mark smiles when he says this, for he's revealed the secret. That sense of pride that comes from camp, that is really important. There are other factors that are important too, that are tied to that, like honoring your traditions. Then comes the modern world, which is the business aspect, making money. If my students don't pay, I can't run this camp. And finally, of course, there's the primal source in every fighter, gameness. Being cut out to do what you do. But the camp has room for everyone. Guys who don't fight hold pads or find another way to fit in. I keep everyone so close to me. That's what makes me successful. They're part of a family. A lot of my students here have grown with me. It becomes a passion and makes them stronger. At the end of a hard training session, I have them all walk around with their hand up, because they're all winners, and they're all my winners. He pauses, thinking long and hard. That's most of it for a trainer. It's about building that trust. You don't marry someone you just met, right? The guys who are around long enough, they trust me, because they see what I'm about. For the top guys and the amateurs. A trainer you don't respect and trust, you can't learn from. So I have to maintain my integrity, you know? I asked Mark to elaborate on his game plans, on all the success he was having in the UFC. How was he going about it? That trust is crucial if you're going to have success with a game plan in a fight. Of course, the first thing you got to think about is, can my fighter listen to a game plan? Can he execute? Or will he be too emotional? Emotional fighters are useless to give game plans to. So are amateurs. Someone too inexperienced. They can't hear you anyway. So with a guy like that, you don't even tell him what the game plan is. You just train him so that what he's doing is the game plan, and he doesn't know it. I think it was Cus D'Amato, the legendary boxing trainer, who said, "I get them to where they can't do it wrong even if they tried." Meaning he would train his fighters to do the right thing until it was instinctual. But if a fighter can listen and stay composed, the first step is understanding the opponent. I don't watch tape over and over. I watch just enough to know what's happening. You have to go with your gut reaction, the first time you see the fight. Because the more you watch, the more you can convince yourself of something else. You clutter your mind. When I was a fighter, the more tape I watched, the more I'd be surprised by stuff. Mark breaks into a surprised voice, playing the confused fighter. "He didn't look like he had power, but he hits hard. I never saw him throw a left lead kick, but he's been doing it all night," he laughs. So I watch enough tape to get an understanding, then I shut it down. With MMA these days, everyone's traveling. So I find out where he's preparing, who's in his camp. Is he in Thailand, or is he at Team Quest? If everyone at whatever camp he's at has a great single-leg takedown, we'll work on defending that. Always, there is the individual you've got. Like Kenny Florian. He doesn't do well if you overbuild his confidence. His brother helped me understand that. He relaxes too much. Jorge Rivera is similar, but he's also nervous, so I keep him relaxed, telling him, "You'll kill this guy through training so he'll sleep well and train hard." But then, right at the fight, I'll start making him nervous. "You better watch out for this guy, he's really tough." Because Jorge needs that edge. I definitely watched the opponent and his trainer on their way into the cage. How smooth are they operating? How relaxed are they? Are they nervous? Where's the ice? Where's the mouth guard? Are they fumbling around? Well, if the captain of the ship is a nervous wreck, there's a problem on board. And the reverse is important. When I come in, it's like clockwork. Everyone has a job. Everything is on schedule. I keep it perfectly organized. Like feng shui, I know where everything is and everything is right. The fighter gets water the second he thinks of it. He gets his mouth guard the second the referee asks for it. He turns to me and boom, I slide it in. If a trainer doesn't know something or is nervous, it's the beginning of the end, because it will carry over into the fighter. When you see chaos in the locker room, that's a bad sign. I still go to a lot of amateur Muay Thai fights, and for a guy's first fight, I just make sure he knows it's a sport. There are people here. This is a controlled environment. He's not going to kill you with a knife. In fact, when it's over, you guys are going to be best friends for about a month. He laughs. I've just seen it so many times. I tell my first-timers, you may hate it or you may love it, but you'll learn something. It'll be a great experience. That night, we drove through the frozen streets in a caravan to legal seafood. I sat between Kenny, Mark, Patrick Coate, a top 185-pounder, and assorted guests. We all listened, rapt, to Marcus Davis, another UFC professional with a battered friendly face, tell truly terrifying ghost stories. As we ate, I felt the warmth of camp all around me. The King of Scrambles. If you continue this simple practice every day, you will obtain some wonderful power. Before you attain it, it is something wonderful. But after you attain it, it is nothing special. Shunryu Suzuki. Mixed martial arts, the modern-day proving ground for hand-to-hand combat systems, introduced ground fighting into the collective conscious. Hoyce Gracie proved, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that fighters who couldn't fight on the ground were easy pickings for those who could. He used a family variant of the Japanese martial art jiu-jitsu, called Brazilian or Gracie jiu-jitsu. What the world didn't know was that MMA fights had been taking place in front of massive crowds in Brazil for 50 years or more, under the catch-all name Vale Tudo, anything goes. The Brazilians knew the value of ground fighting, and the Gracie family knew how to take a good striker out of his element. The philosophy has always been a part of fighting. Take your enemy from where he wants to be. Make him fight your fight. Simply put, jiu-jitsu is at the heart of MMA. The art today is essentially interchangeable with submission wrestling or grappling. At this point, it's semantics. Although jiu-jitsu usually includes practice in the gi. The gi is the white judo kimono, and is how jiu-jitsu was originally taught. But in MMA, the rules have been changed, so the gi is not allowed. Fighters learn a style they, inventively, call no-gi. No-gi is quite different than gi. The gi training utilizes the fabric, sleeves, collars, pant legs, to control the opponent, while no-gi is submission wrestling, with no fabric grabbing allowed. I personally don't like training in the gi because it negates all my natural advantages, strength and slipperiness and conditioning. And my first day in it, in Brazil, I tore my rotator cuff. I'm focused almost entirely on no-gi, and that's what I will primarily be referring to from now on. Modern MMA mixes the no-gi game with punching, kicking, elbows and knees. Grappling for MMA is quite different than grappling for no-gi competition, where there are a lot of slick moves that won't work if someone can punch you in the face. A simple rule change to the sport fight world, allowing fights to continue on the ground, opened up infinite possibilities. Ground fighting is part of the open-ended nature of MMA, a huge part of what makes the sport so exciting. At its core, jiu-jitsu is about applying leverage, creating mismatches through superior position. I find a way to isolate my opponent's arm and attack the elbow with my whole body. Maneuvers range from wrenching arms out of sockets to cutting off blood flow to the brain. Blood chokes are allowed, while attacking the trachea is not. Temporary versus permanent damage. Viable targets are almost any large joint, from ankles, elbows, and knees to shoulders and neck. The experienced ground fighter has thousands of ways to wrestle his way around an opponent, or to cause his opponent to fall into these positional mismatches. He doesn't match strength for strength, which is what collegiate or Greco-Roman wrestling is, and why wrestling is so exhausting. Though there's a deep technical game in wrestling, the end goal is physical domination through powering the shoulders to the mat. Though there is a lot of wrestling in jiu-jitsu, and strength and size count for a lot, jiu-jitsu's goal is harm, and it makes for a completely different game because there are ways to avoid harm without expending lots of energy. A submission wrestler tries to choke or threaten such grievous injury that the opponent is forced to tap and concede victory, or accept the injury. This is the submission, and the beauty of it is that no real permanent damage is done as long as you submit. It's by far the most benign way to win an MMA fight. Orthodox wrestling has only a few ways to win. Points or a pin. While jiu-jitsu has thousands and thousands of submissions and positions. One of the fascinating things about jiu-jitsu or submission wrestling, or catch wrestling, for Josh Barnett, a modern MMA fighter who maintains that his submission wrestling is catch-as-catch-can dating back to Burns and Gotch, is that it is almost wholly about knowledge. It is one of the few pure arts where a more knowledgeable small man can destroy bigger, stronger, faster men, as Royce Gracie has shown. Renzo Gracie, a younger cousin, one of the great practitioners in still fighting, said, "The beauty of the art is that it is so efficient. It molds itself to whomever is practicing. As long as you stick with it, you can be a good fighter. It's not only certain body types or athleticism. I've seen guys that couldn't run or jump for shit, with no coordination at all, become unbelievable champions because they dedicated themselves. The other fighting arts, even judo, wrestling, boxing, they all depend on athleticism. I trained judo my whole life, but the moment I get out of shape, I lose everything. Boxing, you need speed, even when you have a lot of experience. Jiu-jitsu is about dedication and knowledge." Here's a basic primer on ground fighting. If you train, please skip ahead. When two men are fighting, they often fall to the ground. The Gracie theory is that 80% of fights end up on the ground. Certainly, there is a very good chance it's going to happen, particularly if a fight goes past a few punches. When you and I fight, you rush me and we tumble to the ground. There's an initial scramble for position, where nothing is set. The first basic truth of ground fighting is that if you can manage it, you want to be on top. The guy on top is winning. He can punch harder, in MMA, not grappling, and his weight is working for him. The guy on the bottom is at a disadvantage if all other things are equal. However, rarely is everything else equal. Some fighters are extremely skilled at fighting from the bottom position. It all starts with the guard. The guard's development as an offensive position, a place to attack from, revolutionized fighting. The guard is basically the missionary position. If I'm on the bottom, I have my legs wrapped around your waist. This is the best position for me on the bottom, because it contains the other basic truth of ground fighting. It's all about the hips. Your hips, literally, and as an indicator of your body, need to be free to attack me. And you attack with your hips as much as anything. When you're watching two jiu-jitsu players fight, it's not what their hands are doing that matters. The real battle is in their legs and hips. So I'm underneath you, but you're in my guard. That is, my legs are wrapped around your waist. If my legs are locked, it's a closed guard. By controlling your hips, I can greatly limit the damage you can do from the top, and I can set up all kinds of submission attempts from the bottom, as well as sweeps in which I reverse the position, sweep you over, and end up on top. I have all four of my limbs against your two. Animals do it. Watch the bears fight in the Werner Herzog documentary Grizzly Man. It's an MMA clinic with biting. Jiu-jitsu has a progression of positions. The top guy, you, works to improve his position to facilitate his attacks. When you're in my closed guard, there are not a lot of submissions you can attempt on me, and I can control your posture so you can't punch me too much or too hard. So you work to pass my guard, to get your legs around mine, to get your hips free so you can set up the leverage mismatches. If you pass one leg, you're in my half guard. Now, I still have both my legs wrapped around one of yours, and partial control of your hips, but it's generally not as safe for me. You have a lot more submissions, and it's easier for you to punch me. In strict submission wrestling, half guard is very effective for the bottom man, but in MMA, where the guy on the bottom can be eating punches, it's more dangerous. You throw some punches, drop an elbow in my face, but that's not the point. The point is you freeing that leg. The real battle is you getting your hips free. Now you pass to side control. You free your remaining trapped leg. You've got your hips and legs free, and off to the side of me, at 90 degrees, often chest on chest. Now I'm really starting to be in trouble. Side control is a very dominant position for you. I'm desperate to get back to guard or half guard, to get my legs back around your hips, to get some control back. From side control, there are a lot of submissions and attacking options for you, and basically none for me. This is also a stable spot. It's hard to get you off. From here, you might go to mount, which is basically guard in reverse. This time, you have your legs on top of my hips. and usually you're sitting on my chest with your knees up under my armpits and raining down punches. Think bully in grade school position. This is obviously a very dominant position for you, although it's a little less stable. I have a better chance of sweeping you and reversing things from here than I did from side control. The final step is if I turn over to avoid damage and you take my back. You climb onto my back, your chest on my back, and attack me from there. There are hundreds of other ways to take my back, from all kinds of other positions. The back is perhaps the most dominant position in MMA, but only if you get your hooks in, meaning you get your legs wrapped around my waist from the back, so you can cling to me and control my hips and match my movements to stay on my back. Otherwise, I'll turn and get you off. Then you'll be on your back, and I'll end up in your guard. So as you take my back, it's critical to get your hooks in. And from there, you usually start working the choke. Fighters have gotten a lot better at defending their backs. So whereas it used to be the end, now it's not always such a sure thing. That's basically the progression of position in jiu-jitsu and ground fighting in MMA. With apologies to all those who know the game. I know there's a lot I left out, but I'm trying to keep this basic. Guard to half guard to side control to mount to the back. Of course, there are hundreds of variations and hundreds of ways to get to any of these positions. And there are ways to skip steps and go right from guard to mount, for example. There are many different styles of guard, with names such as butterfly and rubber and X-guard. There are countless positions for the hands and arms, underhooks and overhooks, and arm drags and so forth. It is this immense variety that gives jiu-jitsu and ground fighting artistic depth. It's a dialogue between minds, bodies meshed and communicating in a subtle, endless game. A game fueled by a desperate life and death urgency, where joints get smashed and fighters choked unconscious. The ground game jiu-jitsu still seems more mysterious to me than stand-up fighting, punching and kicking, range and footwork. I understand what I don't understand in stand-up fighting, whereas watching high-level jiu-jitsu, I often don't even know what questions to ask. I'm getting better, although my training is still interrupted by my ribs popping out with mind-numbing regularity, a recurring injury. When I first started studying jiu-jitsu, the first thought in my mind was, wow, this is just like chess. And it is, in a sense, because chess also has a strong positional component. In chess, you understand the board, take a strong position, and good things happen. You don't necessarily see the way you're going to win, but with a dominant position, you start to force your opponent to do things like take bad positions until you capture material. In the beginning, you do good things, such as occupying the center of the board, and you position your pieces where they have open files to attack. You develop with tempo. You improve your position and force him to retreat, which builds in a time advantage for you that will show up later in chances to take pieces. Jiu-jitsu, and fighting in general, has this element. You may not be sure what submission you'll get, but getting into a dominant position is a major step toward winning. And in MMA, position is its own reward. Because the better your position, the more effectively you can punch and elbow and soften up your opponent. What I've realized since then is that jiu-jitsu differs from chess in major ways. There is a huge physical component, where strength and speed and conditioning matter. But muscle memory, not a part of chess, plays a titanic role. Moving through positions happens too fast to think. Your body has to have learned what to do, how to protect your arms, how to shift weight to avoid a sweep. In order to be good, you need to log in the mat time, thousands and thousands of hours of just getting beat on by better guys. As Pat Miletich says, you gotta take a lot of beatings. Still, there are some practitioners who are so good, so dominant, that it seems they must be doing something different. One of the most recent examples is Marcelo Garcia. The image that springs to mind is the grainy footage of the Abu Dhabi Combat Club, ADCC, Submission Wrestling World Championship in 03, the biggest submission grappling tournament in the world. The tourney, usually just called Abu Dhabi, was created by Sheikh Tanun bin Zayed Al Nahyan, son of a former UAE president. He was a combat enthusiast and friend of the Gracies. With a love of grappling and some money, he started a championship in Abu Dhabi. And to this day, it is the one contest where pure grapplers can make some money. Abu Dhabi happens every 2 years. Now, due to its size, popularity, and visa issues, it usually takes place in the United States or Brazil. In terms of submission wrestling, it's the cream of the crop, extremely rarefied air. In 03, Marcelo Garcia appeared out of nowhere to blitz his weight class, 66 to 76 kilograms. He was awarded most technical fighter and made it to the second round in the absolute, where fighters from all weight classes can compete. Marcelo's a small guy with a friendly face, an ordinary physique, and a serious look in his eye. At Abu Dhabi, he was like a killer spider monkey, swarming all over these guys, making the best submission wrestlers in the world look helpless. In 2005 and 2007, he not only won his division, but placed second and third, respectively, in the absolute division. He was competing with the best heavyweights, guys 50 or 70 pounds heavier than himself. Go YouTube Marcelo Garcia right now and come back. Mike Cesnulovic, a 205-pound fighter at Pat Miletich's gym in Iowa, and one of the better grapplers at the camp, remembers the first time he rolled with Marcelo. He'd seen the Abu Dhabi footage and tracked Marcelo down to a seminar. This was back in 2004, just as Marcelo was appearing on everyone's radar. Mike recalls with a deep and offended sense of shock how quickly Marcelo forced him to tap out. Mike C is a stud on the ground. He's a high-level grappler who rolls with the toughest guys and rarely gets tapped. Marcelo tapped him in 15 seconds. Then he did it again, a minute later, with the same move. It's the kind of thing that Mike does to me, a smaller guy with about a year of on-and-off grappling experience. Nobody, but nobody, does that to Mike. He laughs about it. I didn't know there was someone out there who was that good at jiu-jitsu. I told Charles McCarthy, Rory Singer, all these UFC guys about him, and they were skeptical. But now, they've all trained with him, and they all agree that he's amazing. Mike laughed some more. First thing they all said, I've never been treated like that on the mat. He's not a normal black belt. I can hold my own with most normal black belts. He's on a different level. It was Mike C. who made me look harder at Marcelo. Marcelo isn't using some secret ninjutsu technique. He's just doing things so quickly, so well, and so far in advance of his opponents that he makes them look stupid. He just seems to have more options, as if everybody else has learned only a limited form of what he does. So I went down to Florida to pick Marcelo's brain. How does Marcelo Garcia think about jiu-jitsu? He'd recently moved there and was training at American Top Team, under the watchful eye of Ricardo Liborio. American Top Team, ATT, is probably the biggest MMA gym in the United States at the moment, with the most top-level pros. It's the brainchild of Ricardo Liborio, who was a member of the mythic Carlson Gracie team and a founding partner of the groundbreaking Brazilian Top Team. Liborio is also a name in the world of jiu-jitsu. Some people say that he has the best game in the world, but his days of competing are long behind him. Now, he's the spark plug and linchpin for ATT. I'd met Liborio briefly in Brazil. He'd understood what I was doing instantly, more so than most of the Brazilians. And he gave me his number and invited me down to ATT. He's an extremely pleasant and warm guy. He'd be the perfect foil to my understanding of high-level jiu-jitsu and Marcelo. I flew into Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and rented a car. ATT was in Coconut Creek, a little north of Lauderdale, lost down into the flatlands. I drove through the press of humidity, the flat swelter of the tropics, and the sense of some vast inland mangrove swamp somewhere outside the strip malls. You can't see much landscape in this part of Florida, it's so flat. There's not much except the stormy clouds, epic and tortured mother-of-pearl cumulus over a blazing pastel blue and red sky. When I walked into American Top Team, a vast, cavernous 20,000-square-foot MMA dream gym, the first person I met was Chainsaw Charles McCarthy. Charles was a fighter who'd been on the Spike TV reality show The Ultimate Fighter, a guarantee of some celebrity, and who fought in the UFC. He was a friend of Mike C., and he had liked my first book, which was cool. If Mike C. vouched for him, I knew he must be okay, and Charles felt the same way about me.